From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster and welcome to The Green Majority. This week, Ian Tao is director-producer of The Nature of Inspiration on CBC Television's documentary channel. The Nature of Inspiration follows a variety of Canada's best visual artists in various locations around the country, discussing how their work relates to nature and the environment. We speak to Ian right after the international headlines. Coming up in the second half, Norm Rubin, director of the Nuclear Research and Energy Probe, and Sean Patrick Stencil, campaigner for leading Greenpeace's anti-nuclear campaign, join us in the beautiful Harthouse studio to talk about the fallout, pun intended, from a nuclear disaster that Canada would have, like the one seen in Japan and Fukushima, for Canadian citizens and the environment. Don't miss it later in the program after your national headlines. However, we're starting today with our international headlines. Welcome, Leah Mazzolini.
Thanks, Darren. There's another gash in Enbridge's reputation after receiving a failing grade for its record of oil spills in a new report. The American conservation group, the National Wildlife Federation, or NFW, highlights all of the gas company's costly disasters in a document released on Monday, July 23rd. The report also slams the corporation's plans to expand its pipeline capacity throughout North America. This document was released 2 days before the two-year anniversary of the Marshall spill. In 2010, a punctured pipeline dumped about 1 million gallons of tar sands oil, and according to the report, the dirtiest type of oil, which seeped into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. Enbridge carries a history of more than 800 oil spills, equating to 7 million gallons of heavy crude oil between 1999 and 2010. However, Enbridge spokesman Jason Mansham says that the write-up contains a slew of false facts, mainly in the descriptions of how the incidents occurred. Despite Mansham's criticism, the NWF stands by their report and calls out to the energy giant to take responsibility in implementing stronger pipeline safety standards. Greenland is looking very different lately, with a large part of its surface missing. NASA released images on Tuesday, July 24th, using three satellites, showing a whopping 40% of the ice sheets melted at or near the surface. The transformation only took 4 days, between the dates of July 8th to July 12th. On the last day, approximately 97% of the ice sheets was defrosting. Historical records show that this happened in 1989 and occurs about once every 150 years. NASA scientist Tom Wagner says because Greenland was thawed in the past, they can't confirm whether this is a natural incident or one caused by human-induced global warming. However, many ice scientists agree that the edges of Greenland's ice sheets are depleting because of climate change. The state of Alaska is fighting new restrictions for cruise lines set by the Obama administration to curb pollution levels. The U.S. government is making plans to restrict large ships from traveling only 200 miles of western North American coastline starting August 1st. They will also have to burn cleaner fuel. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, a trip from Vancouver, B.C. to Alaska emits massive amounts of sulfur dioxide, the equivalent of 13 million cars worth, with as much soot as over 1 million cars. However, the state officials have released concern over how it will affect the cruise and shipping industries, as well as the cost of living for residents due to pricier fuel costs. Yet, the EPA toots that the new rules will avoid up to 31,000 premature deaths each year by 2030, with the benefits outweighing the costs 95-1. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We'll be back with some national news later in the program, but first we're going to take a quick break. Following the break, we'll be back to speak with the producer-director of The Nature of Inspiration on CBC's TV's documentary channel. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back. jusqu'au bout du rail. Et le cœur de neige et les âmes de corail.
Okay, so we are back. We're playing a little bit of a switcheroo today. We haven't been able to get Ian Taves on the phone just yet. We're hopefully going to grab him in the second half. However, for the time being, just a reminder in case you're tuning in now, I am Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. So in lieu, we're moving our features around a little bit. I have Norm Rubin, Director of Nuclear Research at Energy Probe, joining us this morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks.
And also joining him as well is Sean Patrick Stensel, a campaigner for the leading campaigner for Greenpeace's anti-nuclear campaign. How are you this morning? pretty good.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we're going to have a little chat about nuclear energy. I like to do this from time to time. One of the reasons I like to have a little roundtable on nuclear energy from time to time is because, in my feeling, the general discourse in Ontario and in Canada in general is that even if you're environmentally aware, tends to be a alternative energy, solar panels and wind turbines versus dirty coal and oil and the oil industry and the tar sands and all that kind of conflict there. I find like the general discourse, nuclear energy gets left out of the conversation a lot, and your average citizen is not really that well informed, even if they're informed about energy issues, because that conversation tends to be oil sands versus wind turbines. So I was wondering maybe if we can just open it up with just even a comment on that. Do you think that Canadians, we'll start with you, Norm. Do you think that Canadians are really even aware of the nuclear issue in Canada?
I think there's a level of awareness, and it obviously spikes when something exciting happens around the world. Fukushima certainly introduced a lot of people to thinking about nuclear issues that hadn't thought about it before. When you consider how big a share of our energy investment it is in Ontario, how big a share of the risk of the lights going out, how big a share of a bunch of very important policy issues it is, I think all of us who work in this field are frustrated that our next-door neighbors and our in-laws don't think about it more often.
So the another story we've been following, of course, is the Samsung deal that the Premier of Ontario wanted. They were saying there that the amount of solar, I know that deal's been fluctuating around a lot, but the original deal was that they wanted to get renewables in, specifically in Ontario, up to more than the amount of energy produced by Niagara Falls was the statistic that I'd heard, 10% of the share of the grid. Is this sort of a deal, is that going to do anything at all if that ends up completely going through with Samsung? Is that sort of imbuination of renewable energy going to make any impact on nuclear energy and the mix here, or is that just going to be a trade? Is there any relevance to the nuclear when we're talking about investment in solar and wind and stuff in Ontario specifically?
Sure. Conservation and renewables largely compete for the same ecological niche as nuclear power. So there's lots of people have it in their mind that nuclear replaces coal, and that's a little bit more false than true. And a lot of people have in their mind that wind and solar are on the grid instead of coal, and that's way more false than true. But nuclear and the vast majority of renewables, especially the ones we're pushing the hardest, are basically trying to eat the same lunch, and they can't both do it. So the nuclear plans limit the renewable plans, and the more renewable electricity we generate, the more embarrassed we are by the inflexibility of nuclear as well as other things. We just can't shoehorn it into the grid because we have more and more times when we have electricity coming out of our ears and we have to pay somebody to take it. I mean, how stupid is that? And that's because the wind is blowing and the nukes have to run to pay their mortgage, and for technical reasons it's too scary to shut off the nukes. So you have just too much inflexible. They call it baseload, and it's supposed to be a good word in Ontario, but it's only because we've been sold a bill of goods. Baseload means inflexible, and it leads to problems like the problems the grid has now. Sometimes at high demand times we don't have enough, and often at low demand times we're doing crazy things in order to try to solve a problem that we created ourselves.
Mm. Now, my general understanding, I know both you gentlemen do both, but my general understanding is that Energy Probe mostly deals with advising, coming up with policy advice, and that Greenpeace would be more kind of dealing with the word on the street. So we'll go to Sean Patrick. What's the word on the street when you're dealing with kind of your average Canadian citizens? Do you feel like there's a... Is there a conversation happening about nuclear energy, or is this an issue where that people are kind of aware of and interested in and want to talk about, or is this something you find that you have to kind of, even to environmentally interested folks, kind of in get them into the topic?
Well, I think relatively, I was just in Europe, and if you're relative to Germany and, say, Belgium and Switzerland and all these places, nuclear power and Japan right now takes up much bigger place of the public debate. I don't think it's very much of an acute issue here in Canada. The Canadian Nuclear Association put out a poll just last month showing 67% of Canadians oppose outright nuclear power. In Ontario, it's a little different because, as Norm was saying, there's this big debate on keeping the lights on, et cetera, and it's about 50-50. I think for folks that are environmentally concerned especially, we do need to have that debate because, as Norm was just pointing out, there's a conflict on the grid between whether we procure more green energy or whether we maintain nuclear at historic levels. And one thing that's not very well understood is our government has established some policy directives that limit the growth of green energy to keep nuclear at historic levels. That was a political decision that we've had no public debate on that comes with huge risks, financial risks, but as we've seen with Fukushima, also accident risks that have societal implications if they ever do unfortunately happen.
You've been working a lot on liability issues. I want to maybe tie in something with there we've been kind of doing touching base on recently a lot on the program. I changed the image on the Green Majority Facebook page to saying to the sign that was given out by the Death of Evidence rally saying we support our scientists. So talking about, you know, the general discourse and talking about getting people interested in participating, and you said that people like aren't really even having a voice on these issues. That doesn't seem to be just a nuclear specific Canadian issue. This seems to be a widespread epidemic of trying to remove public discourse from the decision-making process. Is that, am I off the mark on that one?
Well, Dorman and I were talking about this before the show. You know, we used to have a process in Ontario where an energy plan would go before the Ontario Energy Board, and there would be at least some superficial levels of debate. The government right now is trying to get rid of that. So, I participated in the environmental assessment hearings last year on the proposal to build new reactors at Darlington. Everything that the public is concerned about with nuclear power was not within the scope of that environmental review. And so there's a certain fatigue that goes on with the public where they do have legitimate cause to raise concerns, but they have no venue for actually putting it forward. And that, I think that leads to a bit of fatigue and people become a little demobilized by that. And we as Greenpeace try to find ways to insert that into the debate of that current environmental assessment we have right now in front of a federal court to try to break that open, of course. But yeah, I think there is a bit of fatigue there.
Is there any, going with that kind of theme before we kind of move back to specifically nuclear issues, but just, you know, while we're talking about kind of Greenpeace and its advocacy, with these ideas of what the federal government's doing with trying to put through kind of basically intimidation laws about being able to speak out, has there been any concern around the office about having to maybe change tactics or methods at all based on this kind of clamp down on basically trying to take away agencies like yours charitable status because of the types of messages that you're trying to put out? Is there any concern, or do you think that this is you're safe?
Well, I think the federal government's been targeting charities, and this has happened to a number of charities. The nuclear industry, I think, went after Energy Probe in the 1990s. When you're actually raising substantive concerns that challenge a government interest, they're going to find a way to try and shut you up. And they've been doing that with charities, the federal government, mostly around oil issues in the West. Greenpeace doesn't have a charitable number. So we're safe in that debate. And we that allows us to speak more broadly on political issues. We're also we try to also be very even-keeled about that. But you'll notice that groups like Ethical Oil have stopped publicly criticizing Greenpeace in the past while because they realize that we're not vulnerable on that front. But there is a concerted effort, I think, by the federal government to shut down dissent and public debate on issues in the West. And we've seen that same thing here in Ontario in the past with nuclear critics, and Norm can talk about that a bit.
Yeah, Norm, why don't we go to that the challenge you had in the 90s with Energy Probe about how successful or unsuccessful have governments been at shutting down discourse on this issue?
Well, this wasn't a case of primarily of the government coming after us. This was primarily a case of us coming after the government. So here was, this started with some blue sky discussions around the coffee maker at Energy Probe. And I think one of my colleagues made the mistake of asking me the question, if I could change one thing, what would it be? And
and that's a terrible question to ask any environmentalist.
Yeah, exactly. My response at the time was that I would trash the Nuclear Liability Act and make the nuclear industry stand behind its products even on a bad day. Make them responsible. Make them responsible for the destruction of environment and public health that they know could happen on a bad day if it turned into a bad day. So, you know, the background here is that I think a lot of the public hears Patrick Moore or other spokespeople for the Canadian nuclear industry or the world nuclear industry portraying the nuclear safety debate as if it's a debate between the techies who understand orders of magnitude and math and hard things like that and the scared meme neighbor irrational people who just want a zero-risk world, don't understand risk, just you know, they're running for their lives against everything and everything causes cancer and take it away. And the truth is that the experts, the mathematical techie experts, many of whom work for the industry, and the neighbors agree. They agree that this risk is unacceptable. They agree that on a bad day, the techies are aware, and certainly the financial experts in the private companies that are involved in the nuclear field, they all know that on a bad day, their company, even if it's as big as GE or Westinghouse, could be wiped out by one nuclear accident, just as the Tokyo Electric Power Corporation effectively was wiped out by Fukushima. And they know that could happen, and they are prudent on the subject. They don't want to say, oh, but the risk is only 10 to the minus. Here, let me do the math for you. They say, no, get it out of here. We cannot run this risk. It's unacceptable. The consequences are unacceptable. Well, that's what the neighbors are saying. They're saying once is too many. They're saying, don't tell me it's one in a million or one in 100,000. First of all, you have no idea. And second of all, I don't care. Once is too many. This is unacceptable, an unacceptable consequence. And so once you realize that the prudent voices within the industry, within the risk makers, actually agree on the subject of risk with the prudent voices from the risk takers, from the possible victims, once you realize that, you realize that the only people who seem to disagree are the PR flacks who are telling us that we're all being irrational, and the government that has caved in to protect the risk makers from responsibility for their own actions. So anyway, we had this discussion around the coffee maker, and it led to a mega project by Energy Probe Standards. We ended up challenging the constitutionality and the charter validity of Canada's law, which protects the industry from responsibility for its own actions, which was called the Nuclear Liability Act, and it limits the total responsibility of everybody who causes the accident to $75 million with an M, which might or might not cover the cost of photocopying and paper clips after an accident. We got a number of co-plaintiffs. We ended up with the recently departed Dr. Rosalie Bertel and the City of Toronto as co-plaintiffs. And we had Clayton Ruby as our chief lawyer of record. And we went tilting at this windmill. And we got standing to some people's surprise. We got the right to go into the lowest level of court with this, and we were planning to appeal to the Supreme Court whether we won or lost. What we weren't counting on was largely that we got assigned what I loosely, off the record, of course, call the judge from hell, who did not see
much. I'm afraid you're on record now. But
oops. Oh, dear. Anyway, virtually all of our arguments were seen as either in the wrong place or the wrong arguments or just wrong. And anyway, we didn't get far. And not only did he write a decision that disagreed with us, he wrote a decision that assigned the costs for the entire trial to our side, which is relatively unheard of in a public interest trial. I mean, none of us was trying to make a nickel on this. Anyway, that had a chilling effect. And we ended up settling instead of appealing. The case, as far as I'm concerned, we still don't know whether the Nuclear Liability Act would stand up under serious scrutiny to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I'm afraid if we find out, it's going to be after a nuclear accident when somebody's going to challenge it.
This whole thing gives me memories of the discussion around oil exploration in the Arctic recently, where I think it was Exxon or BP or somebody, a rep, said, well, we can confront 90% of the oil, as in they'll, we've seen it, there it is, and there it is, and there it is. Sean Patrick, you're chomping at the bit to jump in here, though.
Yeah, well, I think the Nuclear Liability Act, it's still on the books, and it exists in countries around the world. And what we're seeing the implications of it right now in Japan. Victims aren't being compensated. TEPCO caused damages to people, and they can't sue TEPCO. What's happening is the government is compensating victims. And more than that, and Norm alluded to this a little bit, the big multinationals that were partially responsible for this, General Electric, that designed the Fukushima reactors, was also aware of flaws in that design that led to some of those radioactive releases. In a normal world, outside of this law, those victims in Japan would be able to sue GE to get compensation. They are unable to do that. And right now where we sit in Toronto, across the lake from us, are, I think, four or five more Fukushima-type reactors. GE right now is lobbying the Canadian federal government to sign something called the compensation, the Convention on Supplementary Compensation. And what that is a reciprocal agreement that means if there is an accident at one of those reactors across the lake, Fukushima reactors, Canadian citizens will not be able to sue GE for their rightful compensation. GE also last month was in India with Hillary Clinton demanding the same protection to sell their reactors. What that points out is while they're saying these reactors are safe publicly, they're scared of their own technology. They know to be able for that to be worth to go ahead, they need this protection. So we're being told one thing publicly. Oh, it's safe, you know, and renewables, they have all these other problems. But this real huge thing that could change your society, as we're seeing, I was in Japan last year, that society is changing. You're having protests of 100,000 people every month. Japan wasn't like that a year ago. And it's exceeded kind of the levels of risk that are tolerable. And this Liability Act basically protects the polluters, as Norm was saying, and it's different from all other types of laws. I think the only other industry that has it is actually the offshore oil and gas industry.
A question I like to ask on this sort of topic is always, you know, would be something along the lines of how many GE executives live within 100 miles of a nuclear plant. Now, I'm going to have to go from memory here, but there was an article I remember in the Toronto Star a couple years ago where they showed an image, and one of the conversation that comes up when we're talking about this, I got into it with a gentleman the other day just on the street about it, was like, well, you know, wind turbines and everything, because, you know, saying, well, some people don't think wind turbines, for instance, are very attractive. And I think, well, personally, first of all, that's subjective, but I happen to think they're attractive. But my argument against that is, regardless of what your subjective opinion on the appearance of wind turbines is, what would you rather look at? You can't tell me that you'd rather look at a coal factory than a wind turbine, or a nuclear factory than a wind turbine. And what they said back to me was, yes, well, but, you know, wind turbines tend to be scattered around and you see them, whereas they like to hide nuclear plants and coal plants out somewhere. Which brought up this graphic that I saw in the Toronto Star, which was that the original planning, I don't remember if it was Darlington, but it was one of the Southern Ontario nuclear facilities, where, like, originally they had maybe a 500,000 people living within, you know, they have like three blasts, like a severe meltdown, medium, and then small accident, and what amount of density of people live within those kind of ranges. And it was from, like, the time that the plant was built was, you know, very small. There was like maybe 20,000 people that lived within a low, you know, high risk area, and, you know, 100,000, whatever. And now those numbers have gone up by orders of magnitude. There's like 8 million people within like a medium-sized meltdown blast. So, I mean, one of those other issues too is, you know, we're talking about the liability issue there with the protection for nuclear agencies in Canada. Then there's the issue that you brought up around people's voice, you actually being able to be heard. And I just wanted to ask you about a further issue, which is, does your average person even know what the risk is? Like, it's such a complex issue, as Norm was saying, with all the numbers and math and this many and that many, you know, this amount of radiation over that amount of time. And I mean, is there a certain degree where maybe there hasn't been so much movement on this is because it's just such a complex issue that most people just don't have the time for it, or they just don't, you know, have the time to put in to understand it?
Well, in a way, it isn't complex. It's a very dangerous. These are very dangerous facilities because those people operating them won't take responsibility for them. The best people to actually make an accounting of, you know, how risky this is OPG and General Electric say, you know, we will not, we wouldn't have built these unless we had this protection. So they understand the risk of these facilities. And for the public out there, I think one of the big problems we have is there's a whole issue with transparency, especially post-September 11th, on actually getting information on the safety of these stations. And I'll give you a really scary example. And Norm alluded to this a little bit earlier. When the nuclear industry says, we think our reactors are safe, what they mean is, we think generally there'll only be one major reactor accident once every million years of reactor operations. Okay? Generally. And I put in comments last week on OPG's proposal to extend the life of the Darlington nuclear station. And I managed to get a copy at the last minute, they finally released it, of the summary of their probabilistic risk assessment. One of the things that it showed is the first time they ran the risk assessment, there was a very big accident scenario. It would have been 3,000 latent cancer deaths would have been caused by this that came in well above their line of one time every 6 million. That would have meant we should have considered it within the environmental assessment. What did they do? They changed their modeling. So suddenly it wasn't happening 5 times every million years. It was happening once every 10 million years. And thus they could just simply dismiss it for the public. So that's, you know, there's only 100 years of reactor operation at Darlington. They're making submissions on like a million years and just asserting that it's safe. And we don't have access to those actual risk assessments. So I think the best thing for the public in terms of understanding the risk of these stations, if they're not ready to take responsibility for it, it's actually not safe.
All right, so we're running very, very low on time, but Norma, I want to give you the last word on this.
Well, there's a great old talking blues called the Talking Atom Blues, and there's a great line in it that says, Einstein says he's scared, and when Einstein says he's scared, I'm scared. In this case, you can see GE and Westinghouse are acting scared, and when they're scared, I'm scared. They understand the risks. The risks are unacceptable to them. The risks should be unacceptable to us. Not all the neighbors agree, but they should.
All right. So that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us, gentlemen. But Norm Rubin, Director of Nuclear Research at Energy Probe, is there any web information or anything you'd like to direct people to?
Yes. One simple way, if you go to energyprobe.org, you'll get forwarded to what our real URL is.
Okay.
And you'll see a lot of information. I hope there's still information there, even about nuclear liability, but I haven't checked lately.
Absolutely. And Sean Patrick Stenzel, the campaigner for anti-nuclear campaign at Greenpeace, thank you again for joining us as well. And is there any resources you'd like to direct folks to?
Yeah, this fall we're ramping up pressure to try and get the Darlington station shut down. Go to greenpeace.ca/stopDarlington.
All right. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining us. And we'll be right back. We're going to have another little break and we'll be back with some national headlines. Stay tuned. All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. We just finished up an interview talking about some nuclear liability issues here in Canada. You can go ahead and get that off our website, hopefully, because we're actually currently having some website trouble at the moment. If you're if that's how you normally download the podcast, stay tuned. We'll be getting it back up as soon as possible. You can, of course, still go to CIUT.fm to hear the show there, and our syndicates will be getting the show. So please bear with us if you're having a little trouble accessing any of our resources. We're having some trouble. We'll get that back up for you as soon as possible. However, for in the time being, welcome back, Leah. She's got our national headlines.
Thanks, Darren. The annual meeting of Canada's provincial premiers have been defined by an emerging struggle over the proposed Northern Gateway pipeline. The pipeline, intended to carry crude oil from the Alberta tar sands to the coast of British Columbia for exports overseas, is causing major contention between the premiers of two provinces involved. Under pressure from environmental and First Nations group, the BC Premier Christy Clark has laid out five conditions that must be met in order to consider approving any crude oil pipeline, including the Northern Gateway project. The requirements are a full environmental review, installing world-leading practices and prevention systems for both land and coastal oil spill risks, ensuring the rights of affected First Nations are upheld, and ensuring the economic benefits to BC reflect the level of risk associated with the project. As currently proposed, BC would receive 8% of revenue generated by the pipeline, while shouldering half the land-based risk and all coastal risk from a potential pipeline spill. Environmental critics have called the BC government's proposed criteria weak, especially due to the risks of bitumen spill in coastal waters. Current world-leading oil spill recovery tactics are unsuitable for a bitumen spill, as it is much heavier than conventional oil and is resistant to dispersants such as those used in the Gulf of Mexico cleanup. Environment Canada signed an agreement this week with Interpol to help boost wildlife law enforcement globally. Environment Canada is committed to providing a series of specialized wildlife officer training courses, including theory, human rights, inspections, search and seizure procedures, investigations, prosecutions, and intelligence gathering, with a particular focus on preventing poaching and trafficking of illegal animal parts in Africa. Environment Canada has been supporting Interpol's environmental crime program with grants and has been testing a pilot version of this training since 2011 with enforcement officers from 11 African countries. Over the past 3 months, Interpol has arrested more than 200 people across 14 African countries, seizing 2 tons of contraband ivory, 20 kilos of rhino horn, in addition to illegal lion, leopard, and cheetah pelts, and crocodile and python skins. And that's all for the national news. I'm Lee Maslany.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm just wondering if we have online a little bit. We're going to, I think we're missing are we missing our guest, I think? Okay, so unfortunately, we're going to have to go to our backup feature. I just want to let you know that Ian Taves, however, was the producer and documentary of The Nature of Inspiration. That's going to be broadcast on the CBC Documentary Channel Saturday, August 4th at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and Sunday, August 5th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Documentary programs on CBC are always of very high quality. We've spoken to Ian Taves before, and his work is excellent. So regardless of not being able to get him on the line today, I highly recommend giving that a chance and a look. You can go to CBC's documentary website for that as well. However, we're going to go to our backup feature today. The backup was just one we recorded a little while ago, and it was dealing with the oil industry in Nigeria. We're going to go to that now. Today I'm talking to Sandy Siafi, a documentary filmmaker based out of Seattle. We're going to be talking about a documentary that she produced and will soon be releasing called Sweet Crude. Welcome to the program, Sandy.
Thank you so much for having me.
So just before we jump into this program, I want to get a little bit of a background on you. There are three things that are listed on your website as far as previous projects. So just to give people a little bit of a context, because one of the first things that you say in the documentary, I was allowed a bit of a sneak peek, was that you thought you were going to the Niger Delta to make a film about the library, the Niger Delta Friendship Library.
That's right.
This is not obviously what you ended up covering. So with that in mind, let's just briefly touch on your other projects here: Crocodile Tears, Terminal 187, and Just Us. To give people an idea of what the types of things that you're used to working on. So if you wanted to comment on those projects.
Sure. Those are actually all narrative projects, and The first one you mentioned was made a long time ago, and it was a story, a Faustian tale about a man who's HIV positive and sells his soul to the devil. It was sort of a black comedy, and that was a long time ago, and it was before protease inhibitors and very different kind of community engagement. So a lot of my projects have been community-based, a lot of people who are filmmakers and non-filmmakers working together. And I was actually invited to, over the years, I began to do more and more nonfiction. And I was invited to film the Friendship Library Project because I had done a piece on the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride in the United States in 2003. And the people who worked on that knew that I was a filmmaker who did straight up, you know, some straight up videography of community action. Mm-hmm. So I was with an American nonprofit that was heading to this, you know, sort of quote unquote poor village in Africa where the children have no books. And a lot of Americans, you know, ask their neighbors to give money and books. And it all seemed it's very well intended. But as soon as I got there, it was very clear that I'm in a place where there's billions of dollars of oil. So why would they need books? And it felt like this kind of neo-colonial infantilization of people in a very unnecessary and possibly even damaging way, even though that would have been unwitting for the people who did the project.
Mm-hmm. And as far as kind of overlapping with that idea, so of course it says in your bio that about work with human rights organizations. So I mean, you're no stranger to this kind of general topic of following movement and human rights issues and injustice issues. Do you want to talk a little bit about just how that framework kind of framed your decision to abandon the library project and change it into something about the Niger Delta's crude oil reserves?
Exactly. In 1998, actually, I was a part of a team of filmmakers who were in Northern Ireland to document the transition during the Good Friday Peace Agreement. And my job specifically was to document whether or not the RUC and the policing forces were living up to the agreement during what's called marching season, which sounds benign, but for people who know the area, it's not benign at all. And I think in that framework, you know, I learned a lot about how young militant organizations have an opportunity to transition to being political or not have the opportunity to transition into being political if there's no one in the world that's witnessing what's happening. And I saw immediately on the ground in Nigeria that there were a group of young militants who were really asking the U.S. and Europe in particular to get very involved in paying attention to the political struggle, because they were only being seen as kidnappers of oil workers rather than as a political movement. And that became, for me, the focus of the job of a person who ends up with a camera in a place like that, and you know, the job of that person to make it possible for witnessing to have a role in a nonviolent outcome.
This transfers very easily to the kind of age-old problem of the difference between freedom fighters and terrorists.
Yep.
Do you want to talk a little bit about now that we're kind of dealing with the Niger Delta issue with regards to companies like Chevron and this sort of idea, having to do with the portrayal of the opponents of this industrialization by foreign nationals companies?
Absolutely. It's the central, in many ways, the central question for me in always what I held over my head about my standards in terms of what footage I leave in, leave out, how I narrate the film, and the ways I'm trying to offer kind of a fair fight for the audience to know when my perspective is being skewed. There's no doubt that one of the central questions in the Niger Delta, both now and over the last 30 years of oil production, has been, is the resistance movement a freedom-fighting movement? Is the resistance movement a terror movement? And I would say that the third choice, unfortunately, has become, are they dismissible gangsters? I think that's the road that the U.S. media has chosen ultimately, that these are just guys who are getting their pockets lined. And sadly, many of them are. And we've actually played a role in that. But I would say that what I really saw happening in, particularly American media, was the instantaneous assumption that there's just terrorism afoot, and by using fomenting that fear in the American public, I feel very concerned that that was a part of Chevron and Shell's long-term plan to get everyone in the U.S. and Canada excited to drill anywhere. That mm-hmm. if you get us afraid enough about all them foreigners, I mean, we talk about foreign oil here, and honestly, it sounds like that, like, oh, this scary black men with masks on, and do you really want your oil security to be in their hands? And that's been used to get us to say, yes, Keystone Pipeline, yes, tar sands, yes, BP oil spill, whatever. We don't care about dolphins. We're scared of those people over there. I mean, that is the narrative that I think they're banking on.
Now, that perfectly transitioned us to the next thing I wanted to talk about there, because you mentioned, obviously, a strong kind of undertone of racism, and also the strategies with which opposition to these projects have been done kind of tails in nicely with, I want to ask you about Ken Sarawiwa, but to give a little bit of a context before I ask you to comment on Ken Sarawiwa, there was a graphic that kind of scrolls during the beginning of the film that just outlines kind of very quickly, just kind of overlines the kind of transition of you know, what the people have been experiencing for the past several hundred years. It just describes, just very quickly, just to say what the graphic said, 1500 to 1800, 3.5 million people enslaved in Nigeria and sent to the Americas as slaves, 1861 to 1960, the era of British colonial rule in Nigeria, 1956, crude oil discovered in most of the Niger Delta, and then 1966 to 1999, military rule, 5 coups, 6 assassinations, and 9 dictatorships. Now, it was also noted there that as the British left, and the reason why that kind of notation there was so important, that companies kind of took over to replace them and poured millions of dollars into supporting a series of military dictatorships. So what should be taken from that graphic, you're trying to say in the film, is that these aren't even military dictatorships that are being greedy, that these are essentially you know, international corporation funded regimes, not just, you know, regimes and then companies come in and kind of take advantage of it, but that they were more or less set up by these international companies. That seems to be what you're insinuating there.
That's exactly right. And it's actually something that the companies themselves don't even find particularly distasteful to point out. I mean, they sort of look at it as proud that it's an infrastructure they created. I mean, they are the ones who built the schools and the hospitals. It's just a very strange idea about how to govern people, and it's a really chilling notion that you've got places all over the world that have a sort of old-school blueprint that was colonial. You favor some people over other people. You create a structure that is really beholden in a very benevolent dictator, Big Daddy kind of way, and then you lay on top of that a palimpsest of pure corporate agenda, and that corporate agenda is obviously to serve shareholders, plain and simple. So you have, you know, the Nigerian government, the oil companies are essentially in a brotherhood that just says, well, I'll look the other way on your really bad environmental record if you'll look the other way on my really bad corruption, and then we both get what we want. And what you end up with are communities that have no running water, no electricity, in a place that has obviously more than enough resources to have even a first world quality of life.
Well, and you mentioned in the film as well that a lot of these, you mentioned no running water. Is that, well, they didn't really need running water until the oil companies came in and polluted their existing water reserves. I mean, it's surrounded by water, the delta. That's, you know, what it means. There was plenty of fresh water for them to drink until the oil companies came in. Let's come back for a second. Again, I wanted to bring back to Ken Sarawiwa and the you mentioned the idea of dismissible gangsters and that kind of tangential to the underlying kind of racist undertones to this whole idea as far as how it's marketed to the rest of the Western world, and use that as a baseline to just tell the story of Ken Sarawiwa here, because within that timeline that we gave, the 1966 to 1999 military rule, the execution of Ken Sarawiwa happened in 1995, so that wasn't that long ago, but also long ago enough that I think their strategy has sort of changed since then. So do you want to just quickly outline his story and how that relates to where we are now?
Ken Sarawiwa was probably one of the better-known nonviolent protest leaders in Nigeria. And remember, if you place 1995 in context, he was assassinated in 1995, but his real prominence on the continent of Africa and really well-known in most of the Western world was 1990 through 95, and he was leading a very strong resistance movement against Shell oil. And it was very true that you had people all over the world boycotting Shell because of him. He was also a political leader and writer. And Ken Sarawiwa was, in typical kind of Nigerian style, it wasn't just that the government went after him to kill him, it's that they went after his reputation, and they actually arrested him on trumped-up murder charges, along with 8 other activists, and all of them were hanged. The U.S. government and the U.N. at the time were sort of actively appalled and outright, you know, we're going to do all sorts of sanctions, and they did follow through on some, but also, again, to place it in historical context, Bill Clinton had faced Black Hawk Down, and the U.S. had sort of no interest in being engaged militarily, at least overtly, with being on the sort of right side of things in Nigeria. And in many ways, people in Nigeria today see that moment was their sort of last great chance of being known by the outside world as having a kind of righteous cause. it was also right on the heels of Nelson Mandela becoming president in South Africa, and many people feel this morning that Nigeria lost its moment. And from there, the shift of the youth movements have gone through many expressions and many undulations. But sadly today, a great deal of the anti-oil company movements have become kind of enveloped into an arms and money and oil race that does not feel particularly politically easy to support for almost anyone, even those of us who are really sympathetic.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left, Sandy, but just to kind of close off, just to your finish, we've talked about some of the politics and about some of the context under which this was happening. Let's just mention right before we go here the actual environmental impact, the legacy now of 60 years of crude oil exploitation in the Niger Delta. Some of the things that were mentioned there was some of the citizens describing saying how they have to describe animals that used to live in the area to their
yep.
children because they don't exist anymore. One of the other things I noticed was that people that were being talked to, these aren't kind of youth hippie protesters, these are regular citizens, and they
That's
seem
right.
fairly pissed off. It was one of the things that I noticed was, this is extremely well-spoken, extremely educated people but they weren't being academic about what they were saying. They're not
exactly.
mincing words. They're extremely upset, and they, they believe that the facts and justice would be on their side if there was justice. And I think that's two of the things that struck me the most, was that the people that you were spoken to were exceedingly well-informed about the political and environmental and geopolitical issues that were at play here, and very able to communicate them clearly, and very, very, very upset.
Yes. And what I have seen since then that has been, to me, to turn what we're discussing to a slightly hopeful note, I've traveled to parts of the world like the west coast of Ireland, where the community of Rossport has been fighting Shell oil. I was in the Gulf of Mexico after the BP spill. What I'm seeing in terms of the community in the Niger Delta and the communities around the world is an understanding that for all the complications we're discussing, there's also a simple truth. There's almost, in the history of the planet, there's almost never been a resource the likes of which oil has become in terms of the devastation of the planet and the speed with which we've devastated the planet. And the community's understanding that if they're going to see future generations, for any of us, that fate is really tied. And those communities understanding the struggle of each other around the world is part of the emboldening part of the conversation, which brings us, certainly in Canada to the discussion about tar sands and what the Harper government is trying to sell Canadian people. To me, part of the reason Sweet Crude is a film I'm really proud to have made and I hope more people see is that it's communities like the Niger Delta in Nigeria that are like looking in a window and seeing the future. And you're seeing that future in terms of, a biologist saying after the BP oil spill, well, we're not sure what a long-term use of an oil dispersant might do. Well, I know what a long-term use of an oil dispersant will do because I filmed it. And that's the place where those chemicals were pioneered. But what's also been pioneered there is the long-term capacity for a community to struggle for some kind of justice.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we are out of time today, Sandy. Again, Sandy Siafi, documentary filmmaker based out of Seattle. The film is called Sweet Crude. Right before we go, do you want to just let people know how they can get in contact with you if they're interested, how they can see the film?
Sure. Well, sweetcrudemovie.com. The film is for sale, but it's also being screened in Toronto next Tuesday evening, and that's Cinema Politica, so you can look that website up and check out the details.
Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Sandy.
Thank you.
All right, and this is Darren Kaster once again, both recorded and live formats. And if you're listening to this off the podcast, that was a record of a record with a record of live, and we won't have live just yet. So we're going to go now. We're going to move on to the last section here. We've got a good friend of the program, Liam O'Doherty, with Taking a Global on the line. Liam, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Darren. How are you?
Sorry, if we could actually pull the volume up on that a little bit more, just to pull the volume up, that would be great. So, Liam, I understand that you're leaving this evening for an exciting project having to do with Rio. So, I was wondering if you just want to fill us in on what's going on.
Absolutely. So, I'm leaving this evening to go and attend the Children and Youth Major Group Youth Blast in Rio de Janeiro. And basically, what this meeting is about is kind of gathering the young people from around the world to have their policies and concerns and kind of voices heard in this real process. There's been a kind of long consultation process that has gone on up until this point, and now the Rio Plus 20 summit is just around the corner, and so there's this massive meeting of young people in Brazil itself to kind of catalyze and bring together young people to figure out how we're going to continue to influence the process.
Absolutely. And so this is not by any means the first youth-centered programming you've done. You have a long history of working with youth. That is largely what happens over there at Taking It Global. So do you want to just maybe say how this relates to other efforts? I mean, is this the sort of project that Taking It Global and other groups have been doing before? Is this something new? When? What do you expect to come of it?
Well, there are kind of a number of different projects that we're trying to move forward within this CSD, Conference for Sustainable Development framework, and with the Youth Blast itself. One of the biggest things that we're doing down there is virtual participation, basically creating channels for people who are not physically able to make it to Rio because it's very far away and sometimes very carbon intensive to get there depending on where you are in the world, to be able to see what's going on and have their voices heard within that process. And so setting up that virtual participation via Google Hangouts is one of the things that we're doing. Another initiative that we're moving forward there is called youthmovements.org. And that's really about kind of mapping the global youth movements and how they interact with each other and creating just opportunities for people in very different sectors to learn from each other and understand how their kind of issues are aligned and how they can work together. And then the third thing that we're launching while we're down there is a mobile application that's based around commitment. And so young people basically commit to taking specific actions towards the environment through kind of more of a kind of game that happens on iPhone devices.
And so, and with that in mind, I mean, what exactly is the target here? I mean, there's sort of been a long history, and we've spoken about this many times, pretty much almost every time I'd say you've been on the air, because it's one of my favorite questions. But having to do with the idea of part of the whole idea of this is that the youth voice in many ways. Okay, and unfortunately we are out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up for today. Thank you very much for listening to The Green Majority. That, however, was all we've got for you this week. Stay tuned for next week. We've got some more exciting guests that are going to be on the air. However, today, technical production today was by Rose Palmieri. Web hosting and bandwidth for program was provided by web consulting firm rjgcreative.com with web production by Arlie Crawford. You've been listening to The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster, and as I said, that is it for today's live edition of The Green Majority. Until next week, thanks for listening.